I want to welcome everyone to our Keeping on Track open line. We're celebrating 20 years in business and just entering our 8th year of doing this program. We have a few new exciting changes. First, we have a new 2015 open line format, which comes to the launching of our new website. You can also find an archive of past topics on the publication event tab. Plus, our new book, Cracking the Business Code, is available on Amazon or click on the book icon on our homepage. Our topic today, and by the way, this topic is one that came about from requests from our audience because we always ask for different ideas. So the topic is how to create an ownership culture. My name is Dana Baroka. I'm the CEO of Lighthouse Consulting Services. We'll be hosting our program today. We have a few housekeeping items, and we're going to jump right into our topic. For those of you joining us for the first time at Lighthouse, everything we do goes back to our mission statement, bringing effective insight to your organization. We do this through our in-depth work style and personality assessments to raise the hiring bar and assist companies with a variety of services, including interpersonal coaching, executive onboarding for success, leadership training, operational productivity improvement, and exploring global options for expanding your business. In fact, we just opened an office a number of months ago in Taiwan, so if you have an operation in Asia and would like to get leadership coaching for them or providing ideas of how to interact with a U.S. company, please let us know. Our Keeping on Track Open Line series is in response to a number of the calls we get from many of our clients, both domestically and globally, to address the various business issues that organizations are facing today. Our goal is to make this an interactive program, so on your screen you'll see an area you can send questions or ideas during our discussion. We'll attempt to respond to as many of you as possible, so please join us with your thoughts and insights you have along the way. At the conclusion of our program, we'll open up the line so you can talk directly with our guests. So please write down two or three questions to either send in during our program or ask during our open line program. I want to introduce our guests for today. These are both very cool people, extremely experienced, and I'm very grateful that Terry Lauterkamp and Cal Peters are joining us today. Terry is the founding principal with experience as a corporate HR vice president, national international consultant, graduate, undergraduate business instructor, author, community leader. Wow, Terry, this is pretty good. Serves as a practice leader for performance and organizational development. Terry has an extensive background in planning and in implementing large-scale culture change initiatives in forward-thinking organizations. Regardless of the size of the organization, companies need to be thinking in this manner. Terry has been recognized as a peer in the area of open book management and business literacy, an innovative and proven means of building an engaged workforce and a culture of accountability. She has assisted many of our clients in developing a corporate university and has designed and developed and facilitated curriculums for organizations across different industries. Terry supports clients in assessing development needs and designing and facilitating customized training and leadership development programs. Terry has taught countless management courses as a corporate executive, HRD consultant, and university instructor. She's recognized for her teaching excellence at the University of Redlands. Terry received her MA degree in educational psychology from UCLA and has been accredited as a senior professional in human resources. And some of you might know of HR folks that have SPHR after their name, and Terry has earned that qualification. She's a co-author along with Cal, of the newly released book, Think Inside the Box, The Secret to Partnering with Your Employees to Drive Growth and Profit. If you don't have that book, pop onto Amazon. You'll want to get that. Again, the book is called Think Inside the Box, The Secret to Partnering with Your Employees to Drive Growth and Profit. I want to introduce also Cal Peters. Cal manages LTC's Northern California office and serves as a practice leader for business essential training. Over the past 10 years, Cal has played a key role in the design, development, training, and communication of leading-edge programs to improve employee engagement and productivity, financial performance, and organizational culture. She has an extensive background in business finance and passion for developing and leadership talent. Prior to joining LTC Performance, Cal held executive roles with Dun & Bradstreet and World Savings. Cal received her bachelor's degree from UCLA and holds a Series 6 and 63 licenses. I feel privileged to have Terry and Cal with us today and to share ideas that will help each of us in preparing for the future and for dealing with today's business issues. Also, registration for our next program will begin at the end of today's program. The topic will be how to attract, retain, and manage. We're going to do a panel of that generation, so it'll be a very different program. I think we'll all enjoy it. Terry, Cal, welcome. Let's jump right into our topic.
Hey, Dana, thank you so much. Cal and I really appreciate the opportunity to be a part of the conversation today, and we're excited to share with everyone some, we think, practical ideas on creating a culture of ownership, and they're things that we've used that won't break the bank and don't take an inordinate amount of time to initiate. So these are ideas that can be used with companies of any size, and we have successfully used them over the years with companies, I would say, ranging from about 20 employees up to in the thousands. So it's workable and it can be done with companies of all different sizes. And Cal, I'm going to ask you in just a minute to help me out here because for some reason my server is something's acting up and I may need you to move slides in just a minute. As we go now into this concept of culture eats strategy for breakfast, if you would do that for me. And what we're suggesting here is that you take a page from Google's playbook and lead with culture. And what we're really suggesting is that when you put the creation of an ownership culture first, it's been our experience that profits follow. Profits actually do follow. And this means that you have to make decisions first based on values and not on the economics. So when you're deciding on specific actions and things that you need to do in the organization, you first consider the values and don't just make a money or a financial decision along the way. And it's been our experience, I think, that the ownership culture is a very, very powerful driver of long-term sustainable business success. I don't know if you all have seen it, but I recently grabbed a copy of the new book, Work Rules, that's out on the shelves by Laszlo Bock. And Laszlo Bock is the SVP of People Operations for Google. And I just love this book. I really got into it and enjoyed it. And as you all would know, Google is strongly committed to sustaining their unique culture, the culture that they've worked so hard at crafting since the company was founded back in 1998. And, of course, they've had crazy fast growth to where they now have over 60,000 employees, so that just maintaining their culture is practically a business all unto itself. But in the book, Laszlo Bock mentions that he had never heard the phrase, culture eats strategy for breakfast, until he got a letter from someone that had quoted culture eats strategy for breakfast, and he said he just put it up on his wall kind of as an example of silly management gibberish because he just thought this is crazy. But now, interestingly, today he admits the truth in the expression culture eats strategy for breakfast, and he counts himself among leaders from other companies that you all know and familiar with, like Zappos and Starbucks and Southwest Airlines and Whole Foods, companies that have leading cultures and are particularly fans of ownership-type cultures. So today, then, we want to take you through what does an ownership culture look like. And it looks like what you see, if we can advance here now to the next one.
Terry, a question came in. I think you're going to address this later on. Question is, what ideas could be used to engage team members who have no real ownership, or they may feel that it's at some level that they just don't own it? But I think you're going to address this as we go further.
Yeah, but I'm happy to stop and talk for a second about that. One of the ideas that we have used that works really well is something called a goal-sharing program, and that's where everyone gets a piece of the money that's saved when the company achieves goals that everybody's involved in collaboratively coming up with, and it doesn't really cost anything because usually when companies do this, the goals are, it's self-funded. It's a self-funded program, so they get some savings from achieving the goals that the people have come up with, and it gets everybody focused and kind of on the same page, makes people feel like they're contributing, which is a really important thing. You know, we always go for like a quick win, and this is a way to get one. And we have a number of clients that just use this year after year after year and use scorecards along with it, and it's a pretty powerful way of getting that kind of, you know, engagement and buy-in.
Oh, thank you. And I know we're going to talk about scorecarding today a little bit. So thank you very much. By the way, for those of you on the call, please feel free to send in questions along the way, and then we'll open up our line at the end for direct questions so you can talk with our guests.
Okay.
All righty.
So we'll just again go back to what this ownership company culture looks like, and we're saying first that it's based on the belief that people are fundamentally good, and that kind of sounds like a no-brainer, but what we're saying, you have to assume that left to their own devices, most of us, most of the time, are trustworthy and worthy of respect and will do the right thing for the business. And it does demand that leaders have a measure of courage to treat people like owners, because there's been kind of that philosophy in the past that we're just going to control things rather than give people the freedom to act the way owners would act. And so it's really powerful when you have that courageous ability to really treat people like they are, as if they are owners in the business, because you have to trust and respect them to do the best for the organization. And when we say that it requires that principles are kind of baked in, what we're really saying is that it has to be real. In other words, it's not just what is on those big words that are printed posted in big letters behind the reception desk in corporate headquarters, you know, under the lights. It's not what you say you are or what you say you believe. It's what people really do, what's reflected in the way people treat one another. So that's a really important aspect, that it has to be genuine. And then the last point, that it can be virtual or actual. And Kel and I have actually had experience working with both types of ownership, some ESOP companies, and that can be really, really a powerful thing, you know, when companies do create actual ownership by becoming employee-owned, and that's one type of ownership. But another type that's very, very powerful is, again, when you use something like a goal-sharing strategy where you give people a small piece of the pie for being part of creating and achieving company-wide goals. And so what we've enjoyed witnessing is that even when the ownership is more virtual than it is actual, there's still great power when people take ownership in their work and they take ownership in the company's overall results. And I know just one quick story that I'm thinking of is, we had the opportunity to work with a company that was engaging employees in solving a big problem that had come up in the business. And this was a situation where the company had lost one of their major clients, and it was going to be a big financial hit to the business. So they decided to get an employee team involved in solving the problem, and then give a bonus to the team members that would be paid out from the savings. So when the goals were achieved a few months down the line, and the goal sharing checks were passed out, they invited Cal and I to attend a kind of a little celebration lunch that they held at the headquarters. And it was really an amazing experience, because what we noticed is that for most of the people, the amount of money they received wasn't a lot. It was a small amount of money, $200, $250, but there was an amazing amount of ownership from that experience. It wasn't the money per se, what we began to realize, that it was the fact that they had been involved in the process of solving the problem, setting the goals, and achieving the goals. And so it made $250 seem like a much bigger deal than it would have ordinarily been.
Terry, a question came in, and the majority of the folks on the program today and will be listening in the future are mid-cap to larger companies, but we do have some municipalities on the call today. Mm-hmm. What if the employees are part of a city, state, federal government where cash savings cannot be shared?
And that's great, too. You know, I mean, we worked in a number of settings where no money whatsoever was involved. And a lot of the ideas that we're going to be talking about are things that, again, you don't have to be rewarding people with cash. That's just one way of making it a little bit more real. And so, you know, again, different things work with different organizations in different settings, and we strongly believe that you can create ownership without money, and we'll be talking specifically as we go on today about some of those ways that you can do that.
Perfect. Thank you, Terry.
Okay, so next up, finding and selecting great people who fit, and we kind of alluded to this a little bit earlier. Dana, this is something that we would definitely be singing to the choir about and talking to you on this issue, since this is a big part of what you believe at Lighthouse and what you're committed to doing. But cultural fit is so extremely important in ownership environments. And what we've seen is that the companies that have these strong cultures want to ensure that candidates have the can-do, the will-do, and the fit. In other words, they have the skills and experience to do the job, the can-do. They have the motivation to do the job, the will-do, and they have the qualities and characteristics that fit with the culture that you are trying to create. So that fit thing being a really key part of it. We mentioned that it's important not to be afraid to hire people that are smarter than you. Over and over again, we've seen that in these ownership culture kind of companies, people are fiercely loyal to the brand. They know that they need to get the A players. They know their success depends on having the best and the brightest, and that it means pushing aside ego and being willing to hire someone who can do the job better than you can do the job, and that's why you're hiring them. And then just finally, making sure that the cultural cornerstones that you've established do resonate with the people that you're bringing in. And we are proponents of teaching the culture to newly hired employees, and Cal's going to talk about that in just a few minutes. But beyond teaching it, it's really important to select individuals who are naturally oriented to the values that you've already established. So while you want them to learn, you don't want to have to change someone who doesn't have the kind of characteristics that you already need. And I think with that, I will turn it over to Cal to talk a little bit more about how we suggest you paint the big picture.
Cal jumps in, we have two questions. The first one you guys will be addressing, but let me throw it out there, and then you guys can talk about it later on. But how accountability works into the ownership culture, and I know you're going to be talking about that later, but I want to make sure you address that.
Okay.
This is such a hot topic, by the way, and that's everyone's very interested in this subject matter. Second question is, what currencies have you used when financial rewards are not possible? What is your experience in working with unions where employees are often longstanding and not interested in a culture of accountability and use the unions to protect them?
Boy, good questions. I know that the first question will be addressed in our presentation in just a little bit. The second question about unions, we have worked with several organizations where unions were involved and where there was an us versus them kind of mentality going in to the going into the experience, where really the unions there really was a very severe disconnect between the employees and the union. And by using a lot of the kinds of techniques that we're talking about, helping the people to see the big picture, helping them to understand what the goals of the organization are and some of the financial numbers involved in the organization, they begin to feel like they were a part of the team instead of a part of sort of second-class citizens or a separate group of employees that weren't regarded as highly as others. And so I think actually both of those will give you some examples and talk through as we go forward here with this.
Thank you. And also, when the concept of union is thrown out, a number of individuals on the program might think, well, I don't have a union, but you can have silos of people that think like a union person and maybe feel separated at some level. So it is a very applicable topic to everybody across the board.
Exactly. And that's actually where we're going right now, I believe, Cal. Yes?
Perfect.
Right.
Cal,
so,
you're on.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for having me. I want to talk here a little bit about painting the big picture. And it's funny you mentioned silos, because one of the things I was going to talk about is that many businesses still do operate in a silo and a vertical kind of organization where folks are in their specialized jobs. It's narrow. They don't really have line of sight to outside of their job, and they don't know what's going on outside. They don't know what's going across the organization. And, you're mentioning unions. I know we had one client where that's exactly what we found, is that management was here and the union and the workers that were responsible for their jobs were over on another side. And trying to bridge that gap, one of the things we did was to provide this line of sight to the company's missions and goals. So it sounds simple in a way, but it required a lot of effort to get everyone on board with what was the mission of the organization, what are the goals, and how do they merge together between management and the workers. So it seems simple, but as you all know, it isn't simple. And trying to get everyone onto the same page and seeing the same thing is key. And in a profit-making enterprise, maybe it's easier to say, well, we make profits or we don't based on how we do. Municipalities and all that are a little bit different. But I like to appeal to their pride of their work and the pride of the company or organization or city or whatever it is that they work for, because people love praise, and they love to know that they're doing the right thing and moving in the right direction. And by having the big picture shown to them, the company's missions and goals, and trying to get the buy-in for everyone, not just the management, but all levels of the organization, can make a big, big difference. What we found, too, is when the folks are involved, and as you get further along this process of goal sharing, when the employees are involved and have input into the goals, into future goals, it's very impactful. You get their buy-in. That high-powered culture that you're trying to get going and sustain really moves along faster and faster when you get the input of the folks at all levels of the organization. So instead of just senior management always saying, okay, here's our mission, here's our goals for this year, go do it, instead from the bottom up. So that's a good objective to move toward. Helping people see why the company does what it does. You know, everybody has a role. Everybody has a job that they're doing. And, you know, they don't always see what everybody else does. You know, I was thinking back in the old days, orientation programs that companies used to have, and they might have been a week long. And you might have had, you know, gee, I'm going to spend time in this department, and I'm going to spend time in customer service, and I'm going to spend time in sales, and I'm going to understand how this company works. differently than my own job, and I'm going to be exposed to all kinds of stuff. Well, now it feels like such a hurry-up day. Everything is like, okay, onboarding, you know, get on board the train, hurry, it's moving fast. Here's your desk, here's your computer, here's your whatever, you know, some forms to fill out, go, get started. And we lose that part about teaching people about their own company and what it's about and why their job is going to be important to helping the organization move forward. And I will share just a small kind of personal example here, also a business example. My family has owned a restaurant. My brother and sister run it now down in Southern California that has been in business for over 50 years. And, you know, there's just not many restaurants that can live that long. My parents started it way back when, and they took it over. And what you see there is this pride of ownership and the people, the customers that come in there. I live in Northern California, and I go down to Southern California, and I go there and people, you know who I am and that it's a family organization and that, you know, the people that work there have pride that this is a company that has been passed on to a generation and prides itself on good food at good prices. And so it keeps people there. It keeps them engaged, and it's one of the reasons that I think they've continued to be in business for so long and be successful. So teaching people a little bit about the background of your organization and besides the future, also the past, can be really helpful. And we overlook that sometimes, I think. Sharing how your business delivers value to your customers and makes a difference. We all kind of know that the customer is king. I mean, everybody that knows anything about business knows that, and everybody needs to get on job, you know, get on board with that in terms of whatever their job is. I was thinking about a recent example I saw, it was just in the newspaper the other day about a company that makes SpaghettiOs, and I don't know if you saw it, but there were some quality control issues where they had some red plastic that was in the can of SpaghettiOs, and it caused a problem, of course. It hurts their reputation. It hurts their business when it's not perceived to be a quality or value to the customer. So one person's or two people or whatever, a mistake in that quality can affect the entire product and the business and the profitability. And we all know those kinds of things, people don't always forget about them very quickly. And so you can just have a huge negative impact on your company. And you want to make sure that people understand the value that the customer has and how important it is that the customer is always at the forefront.
That's a really important thing for all of us to remember, because as business owners or key executives, there's an assumption that others simply know. But sharing the business, what the deliverables are and the value to the customer, that's huge. Another question came in. What do you recommend showing people to share companies, the goals, key performance indicators, et cetera, et cetera?
You know,
well, that's a good one
for
you, huh, Cal? You're about to.
Yeah, I think I am going to talk about that in a second anyway, which is great. So, you know, it depends on the kind of company. One of the things you see is there's the difference in public companies, there's a difference in private companies, and maybe what can be shared or wants to be shared. Sometimes private companies are a little private about their financial information, about information with their company. But there are certainly things that can be shared across all organizations. Of course, the biggest one is probably company performance against their goals. So if goals are set for the organization, providing progress reports for how we're doing against those goals, whether they be financial or other types of goals, is really key. Revenue and sales are always good ones to use, because if you're a company that everybody kind of understands that the more sales you have and the more revenue you have, the better off you're going to be. And so everybody understands that's a driver. And if you can even, that's not the kind of number, it's not profits for the company, but it's the revenue that you can publish and educate people about and understand that that's something you can measure and can measure the progress of how you're doing. And as you get along further, you can get into things like operating expense or EBITDA or some other financial measures that you can describe to people and have them work towards. But you have to start out small, I think, and start out with just some basic things that you can get people going and sharing the information. Because you'd be surprised how much it means to people to even know what the sales of their company are. If you ask people sometimes, how much in annual revenue does your company do in a year? I don't know how many people could actually answer that question. And it's a very basic one and a simple one, but it gets people involved in the company and feeling like they do have a stake, and they understand a little bit more what it feels like to be from an owner perspective. So let's talk about teaching everybody about business. You know, we've been hired extensively, Terry and I, to teach people about business and how to become business literate in the sense that will help them in their company. And, you know, you have to teach people at all levels. You know, we think about the managers. It's like, okay, you know, you've got the owners, you've got the senior management or the managers of the company. And if you just tell them, then they're going to carry it forward to everyone else. But it really is important to involve all levels of the organization. And the lower levels sometimes get overlooked. And we make assumptions that everybody understands business principles, that they know what it means. And really, I found some data on this, which is very interesting, that, you know, only about 30% of the workers in the U.S. are college educated. And of those, about 7% are business majors. So most people, most of us, don't have background in business. Yet we kind of expect and assume that people understand this stuff. And so it's just getting back to basics. And our book that Dana mentioned, Think Inside the Box, we share a lot of ideas that can be applied to your company about how to teach people about business in a very simple way. And what we found in the companies we've worked with is that it really improves the engagement of the employee, of course, and then in turn boosts the productivity of the organization. So sharing the key numbers, as I mentioned, public companies, all the numbers are disclosed. It's in a prospectus. It's online. You can find it anywhere. Almost nobody can understand it because it's so complicated.
And nobody, the problem.
Yeah, puts you to sleep. And private companies, sometimes that information is proprietary. And so what do you do with that? But I think the key is sharing some kind of number is important and critical to the culture. And how do we do it? As I mentioned, there's different ways that you can share numbers without hurting a business owner that maybe doesn't want to divulge exactly how much profit they make in a given year. We have actually done where in some company, a company I'm thinking of, where we did a profit and loss statement is simply revenue minus expenses gives you your profit. And we did what we call the percentage P&L, where we just showed, okay, here's 100% of the sales. You know, 40% of that money is subtracted out for cost of goods sold. And then that leaves you a 60% gross profit. Take off your operating expenses, which are mostly salaries, and you end up, you know, a 50% operating expense, and you have a 10% profit. And even take people through a very, very simple, that's very simplified, but a profit and loss statement so they understand what does it mean? What is a profit versus a revenue number? Sometimes people mix those up. They don't even know what that difference is. So it's simplifying, kind of demystifying, if you will, the numbers for people. And you know, I'm not a master's in business and or finance. I'm not a CPA. I do understand finance maybe better, you know, a little more than the normal average person. But we try to, you know, the examples we use are things like, you know, in business, they have financial statements. You know, they have an asset, they have liabilities, they have a profit and loss statement. In our personal lives, we also have assets. So if you think of it that way, and we like to kind of throw out the personal life versus business and say, okay, in business you might have some equipment, you know, machinery, equipment that you use to manufacture something. And at home, personally, you may have a car. Those are both assets. And one is for you and one is for the company. The same is true for sales. When you bring in sales for business, that's the revenue. In your personal life, your revenue is your paycheck. It's what you get in every day. You have expenses that offset that paycheck just like the business does. And try to get people to understand some of those parallels so that it makes it easier to understand and, again, creates buy-in to the organization.
So
enabling each person. Yes.
I'm sorry, Cal.
Go ahead.
On that note, there was a question that came in. What if the opportunity to contribute to the future goals is offered repeatedly and employees just don't step up and then complain that nothing's changing? Or what do you do when there's an employee split between new hires and the old guard? The new hires embrace the vision, culture, and being part of the co-creating what's possible, and the old guard status quo starts to create a toxic influence on the new hires.
Yeah, that's a great challenge. And, you know, we've had, I know one experience like that where we had a similar sort of deal. And for one thing, it doesn't happen overnight. I mean, that's all I can tell you. It is a challenging environment. And I think the only thing I know to do is to bring the groups together. You have to figure out, okay, you got these new hires, you're trying to change the culture with them, but you still got these old guys hanging around that aren't buying into the program. And try to get to some of the leaders, some of the people that you can influence in maybe that old group, the group that's not changing as much, and work with them separately or try to influence them to come on over and maybe meet with some of the newer hires and some of the management and try to bridge that gap so that you can slowly wear down those differences and try and bring those people together and find some commonality in their purpose and in the goal so that eventually you start to move the organization in the right direction. But that,
and I think
that is
sometimes we've also engaged some of those old guard as leaders, if we could, you know, try to tap into their experience and have them feel the honor of being asked to take a leadership role in the process to work with some of the younger people and that sort of thing, too.
That's great. Thank you.
Okay, and then just the last point on this slide before we move on is just enabling each person to understand where they're able to influence the profitability. So I know some of the companies here listening, you know, it's not about profits, but it doesn't have to be about profits. It can be about reputation. It can be about outstanding service. Every person, it doesn't matter who they are, an accountant, a janitor, a welder, a customer service person, contributes to the organization's success. And if you can share whatever numbers might be relevant to your company, it does empower people to feel that they're in the know, that there's not secrets about what's going on behind the scenes and you know, that stuff that we don't know anything about. Many companies will use what they call a critical number, and this might be something that the company wants to focus on in a given quarter or even a year, where, okay, we're having a problem with X, and we need to kind of move the needle in the right direction. I can think of an example that I can share that was a company where they were having trouble with their travel expenses, and they just were kind of getting out of line. They didn't have control over what was going on with their travel, and the numbers were just too high. And so they got together an employee group, and they got a cross-section of different people, and they challenged them with, what can we do here? This is affecting the company in a very negative way, and we need to figure out a solution. And long story short, they basically, the folks in the group applied their own personal strategies, right? We all have our strategies when we go on vacation. How can we save money, and what can we get the most for our money? Those same strategies applied to the business with their suggestions, and they came up with about a 20% savings on that line in their expense, in their overall operating expenses. So what was great about that was the people, the employees felt respected, they felt important. It was a win-win situation for everybody because everybody got involved and the company benefited from that sort of resolution and that camaraderie that developed between all those people.
Wow, thank you.
Okay, let's see where we are here. Moving on, okay. Helping people understand how their job makes a difference. Exploring the ways in which each role adds value. You know, there's no one person in any company or any organization or any city or anything else that has all the answers. I don't care if you're the mayor, or you're the governor, or you're the president, whatever you are. Nobody has all the answers. Funny, I was just watching this morning. There's an IPO that just happened today called Square. I don't know if you guys have heard of this company, but they do these mobile payment sort of reader. But the guy, Jack Dorsey, is the CEO of both companies, Square and also Twitter. And And people were asking him, well, how can you be the CEO of both of these companies? And, you know, what do you do? And the thing I heard from him was, hey, I can't do it alone. That's what he said. And I have the best team on the planet. So, you know, here's a guy who's co-CEO of a very successful IPO this morning when they didn't really expect that. And he's talking about his team and talking about people who make a difference. And I think that's what you have to do. You have to create that connection with your people, and they have to understand that they add value. And this connection that you have with your customer is critical also, of course, because some of your companies might, some of the people in the companies may be in profit centers where they're actually generating the sales and the income, and others might be in cost centers where they're in accounting or their customer service. And they need to understand that their jobs are very important as well. And one of the ways that, you can do that, if any of you have ever done this before, I'm sure you have, is having somebody swap jobs with someone else. So, for instance, let's just say, you know, people always say, oh, sales, they get everything. They always have all the benefits and they get all the money. And, you know, have an accountant go out with a salesperson on a call and let them see a little bit about what their role is and how difficult it may be to close that sale. And have the salesperson sit with the accounting person and see what happens when people don't fill out their expense reports correctly and there's issues. You know, same kind of thing. Send a stock person out on a delivery call. All these sorts of things help to build that kind of ownership culture and that understanding about each other and respect for one another in their job and also to the customer. Making work not a job or career but a calling. This is everybody's wish, right? We wish we had people who thought of their job that way. I want to just share an example of what I think is a good company where they have connection to the customer and the job, and that's REI. I don't know if any of you have shopped there before. It's a outdoors sporting goods sort of company, and it's a cooperative, so it's actually member-owned. But those folks, they have a real passion around being outdoors and the environment and service, and, you know, it's chosen in all of their salespeople. If you want to know something about, you're trying to buy a, you know, backpacking tent, you're trying to figure out which one to buy, those people will tell you, and they'll tell you in a way that is very believable because that's part of their culture and it's part of who they are, is that they're informed and they believe it's important. And you can just see it when you're in there and see the pride that they have in the job that they do. So they're kind of an example of a company that figured out how to connect to the customer, how to make the job something of importance and, if you will, kind of a calling. That's the kind of people they try to hire in that organization. Let's move on. Terry, I think, is going to take it from here.
Kind of speed up here and make sure we get this in. But trust, of course, is a very important part. And we say that if you trust people, they will surprise, delight, and amaze you. And, of course, a few people in a few situations might disappoint you, and that's kind of the human condition. But in the book that I was speaking about earlier, Laszlo Bock makes the point that if you're not a little bit nervous, you probably aren't trusting people enough. And so you do have to stretch yourself and allow people the opportunity to even make mistakes if that's necessary to continue to learn and grow. Give them the freedom and the authority and the knowledge. And Cal has been focusing a lot on how it helps to have the knowledge. Don't just expect or assume that people know things, but also the freedom. And I just wanted to mention, I know one example that comes to mind that we had when we worked with an organization that was a distribution company. And the truck drivers in that business were the people who had day-to-day connection with the customers on a regular day-in and day-out basis. And what happened was after we were intentionally working on an ownership culture initiative with them and teaching them about the business and sharing that they were empowered, their management actually went to them and said, okay, to the drivers, we want you guys to have the freedom to work out any customer service issues you have whatsoever on the spot with your customers. And we're going to take away all the bureaucratic red tape needed to process credits and et cetera, et cetera. If you will just make a good decision on the spot with the customer so that they are satisfied and comfortable, we want you to have the ability to make those decisions and those calls. Once they did that, amazing stats followed. The retention of customers soared. The sales, the revenue numbers went up. The drivers were behaving like partners in the business, and those are that's the kind of way that you can give people both the knowledge and the freedom and authority to do their job. And then the third bullet there, find ways for people to have a voice. This is so, so important in today's world. And we had a situation with a client company where they asked the employees, after we had done a business training initiative with them, they said to the customer or to the employees, what is the biggest problem that we have here in the business? And the employees immediately, kind of in one voice almost, said, oh, it's on-time delivery by a long shot. The management was wise enough to say, okay, you guys, come up with a solution. What do you think we should do? They formed an employee team, and within just a few short months, about 4 months as I recall, the team had tackled the problem of on-time delivery, and it had changed the on-time delivery rate from a pretty sad 77% up to 94%. So their voices were heard. They made an amazing difference. It affected the bottom line of the business, and it was just a win-win all the way around the block, for sure. So moving on.
That's a great example. Thank you.
Yeah, just rushing a little bit here because I want to get as much in as possible and we're running out of time. But embrace transparency. This is such an important aspect of what we are suggesting. And we use the phrase that I really love, default to open, meaning instead of closing up and not sharing information and going behind closed doors and having hushed secret meetings with people, the companies that we've worked with that have ownership have a policy that's just default to open. Share information with people. When trust has been established, the leaders aren't afraid to share information, and the people want information. They ask questions, and the leaders really relish the sharing of information with their team members instead of being afraid of sharing. Good news and bad news, and that's a really important point. If you only tell people the good stuff and you don't trust them with the fact that maybe sales are down or a particular customer is not going to be doing business with you anymore, if you don't trust them enough to share the bad news as well as the good news, then it doesn't really work because then you're saying you really don't trust them, right? So the beauty of transparency is you don't have to constantly filter and prepare different messages for different groups of people. You share as much as possible with people at all levels, as Cal said. And that just makes all the difference because it builds in a level of trust that you could never get in any other way. And then everyone knows. People have the knowledge. And like that commercial says, knowledge is power. Well, it's incredible power to have that kind of knowledge. So I don't know. Cal, do you want to whip through this next point real quick, and we'll try to finish up here?
Yeah, sure. So staying the course. Let's see, I'm trying to get the slides to change here. So what we're saying is, whoops, went too far. Once you have this openness, this transparency that Terry was talking about, you have to stay the course, meaning that, you know, you've got to continue to trust, to teach, to listen, to communicate to the people that you're working with at all levels of the organization. You know, I want to ask people in the audience, you know, how many employees have you ever heard complain about, gee, the company's telling me, the management's telling me way too much information. I don't want to know about sales, or I don't want to know about how we're doing, or they're giving me way too much. It's quite often the opposite, meaning that they don't know and they don't understand and they don't see. So once we start that dialogue with people and we give them the information, we have to keep it going. Whether you use all hands meetings, a lot of people do that, maybe quarterly. You can do it in department staff meetings. You can do it just informally at lunches. walking around at break time, just continuing to reinforce that sort of trust and the providing of information and transparency to keep that momentum going. You know, it takes commitment. It takes discipline to keep it going. If you drop off and you stop that communication once you start it, there's a risk there, because then all of a sudden people are like, well, what happened? You know, why aren't we getting this information now? Is this the flavor of the month again, where they tried some program and now they're just ditching it again? So you do have to stay, and you want to keep that kind of formal and informal communication going all the time, because consistency, it's just like when you're raising your kids, right? You have to be consistent in the way that you behave and the way that you lead, so that people will trust and will become part of that ownership thinking with you.
All righty. Well, we just wanted to kind of finish up here with a really important point. And, Dana, I think you mentioned that a millennial panel is coming up in the next session for OpenLine. And this is important because the kind of culture that we've been talking about creating today, this ownership culture, is something that fits really, really beautifully with the key characteristics of the millennial generation. And we all know that the workplace is going to be largely millennial by 2020 or 2025 as the baby boomer generation continues to phase out and retire. And what we know about generationally about millennials, and of course there are always individual differences within, the broad brush of the term, but they really thrive in a collaborative team environment. And I think this is best evidenced by, if you ever go out to dinner with a millennial, you got to stop and, you know, check your apps and see what the restaurant reviews are. These are kids that people that want to know what everyone else is thinking. They want to make decisions based on including the opinions and the ideas of others. They're looking for a sense of belonging. They like the concept of being a partner in something. And so the concept of being a partner in a business that engages people at all levels, not just the top people, but people at all levels, and honors their ideas and their experiences is something that just fits beautifully with the way millennials think and the way they're motivated. You know, they expect development and they want to have a say. They want to have a voice in solving problems. They don't want to just be told what to do or how to solve the problem. They are always seeking development opportunities and learning about your business, learning about how it works and what the goals are a great way to, to do that. And then lastly, I think they don't work well in command and control environments. So the whole concept of having these very strict hierarchies and authoritarian kind of leadership just doesn't jive with an ownership culture, and it doesn't jive either with the way that millennials think and the way they're motivated and the way they function best. So we just find that it's very, very fitting to have an ownership culture with a lot of millennials working in that culture, because they are naturally oriented towards transparency and towards trust and towards knowing about the business and having involvement in it and being a partner in the business. All of those things fit really, really well. So,
Terry, a quick question. What if a company is divided, where half the company is made up of boomers and the newer generation? How do you get them to integrate? Any key thoughts on that?
Gosh, it's a big topic, and I don't know if I have any quick and easy solutions to the process, but I do think that a part of it is just giving people that respect and giving them a chance to have their voice be counted, whether they're a baby boomer and you can pair them up and do some sort of mentoring between possibly boomers and millennials, where millennials have the great, the latest technology and they have talent, but they don't have experience. If you can put the two together, marry the two, that's been our best, I think, secret to success is trying to call upon the experience of the boomer worker with the younger employees, and then just making sure that everyone knows what they're accountable for, and the goal-based systems work really, really well for that. So,
right.
Just to sum it up, I think what we've been talking about today is that creating an ownership culture isn't easy. The word culture implies clear values and norms that guide people in how to operate the business. And sometimes some employees won't do things, behaviors or actions that fit within the values of the norms. And when that happens, you have to consistently redirect them. And that's where the not easy part comes in. Again, it doesn't cost a lot of money, and it doesn't take an undue amount of time, but it requires consistency, and that even means confronting conflict if conflict is involved. It does take a lot of work, and it is constantly changing. And even in a smaller business like many of the organizations we've worked in, things do keep changing. The way jobs are structured keeps changing. The kinds of people you need to do the jobs keeps changing. And it takes real commitment and focus, and it can't be, as Cal said, the flavor of the month or you're in trouble. I guess just finally, in today's world, we think that having that kind of culture will really help an organization to compete and to thrive. And we've seen companies like the ones we've talked about today, Starbucks and Google and Whole Foods and Southwest Airlines, a lot of American businesses, consumer products companies, have seen that culture has amazing power for transforming all kinds of businesses. And it is something that's available to everyone. All of us at all sizes, even in smaller businesses, can use it and leverage it to build the kind of employee ownership that helps you create a team that's really engaged in making the business the best it can possibly be. And when you have that kind of ownership and have that kind of that kind of sense within the organization, it is just so powerful, and we've been honored to have a chance to help companies do that and just see what a huge difference it can make. So thank you so much, Dana. We really appreciate the opportunity to be a part of the conversation. I know we could keep talking forever, but
I know. Thank you, guys. This is a wonderful program and hot topic. We're going to turn the recording feature off in just about a minute or so. Just a couple things before we close, and again, we're going to open up the line if anyone has any specific questions. I want to thank Terry and Cal for being a part of this program. It was amazing. You'll see on your screen, let me just move the slides up here, you can sign up for the December 10th Open Line program, which is entitled Millennials. How to Attract, Retain, and Manage. It's going to be a panel discussion with three individuals that are amazing in their own right, in working out of school, doing their thing, and I thought it would be great for our audience to get direct feedback of what they're looking for versus others just telling us what we think. So please sign up today, reserve a space to yourself, and let us know if you'd like your staff or other colleagues to attend. In the next few days, you're going to receive a recording and PowerPoint of today's program. Please feel free to share it with others in your organization or within your association or trade organization. Once again, Terry, Kel, I want to thank you for participating today. You can see Terry and Kel's contact information. If you have questions, thoughts, feedback, please give them a call or drop them an email. They'll be more than happy to speak with you. Let me turn the recording feature off here, and then we're going to open up the line. We do have quite a number of people attending today, so I'm going to ask anybody that's staying on to please put your phone on mute, and then if you have a question, unmute your phone. All righty, we'll be back in just about 10 seconds, so please stand by.